MacCast, Thursday, December 16th, 2010. Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome to the MacCast, and I guess I have a belated happy birthday for the show. You know, I just realized I'm sitting down to record this. It is December 16th, 2010, and the first episode of the MacCast actually went out on December 13th, 2004. So we've been doing this for 6 years. We've been hanging out together, talking Mac and Apple stuff and geeking out, and it's been a lot of fun. It's been a great 6 years. So I want to thank you for that, and thank you for continuing to listen. And if you're new to the show, well, welcome, and we're glad to have you as part of the community. And I have to say that I never thought that this is where we were going to end up, I guess is what I want to say. I had started out kind of just doing a little news show, and what had happened was the original idea behind the MacCast, I guess back up a little bit, and I've talked about this before, so if you've heard this, you can probably jump ahead. But for those of you who don't know, the MacCast started out as a show. I was listening to podcasts, and I was looking for Mac shows to listen to. This was right when podcasting started, 2004, around October. And there weren't really that many tech shows at that time, not like there are today. And I wanted something. I had a long commute. I had about an hour drive, and I was looking for something that would allow me to catch up on kind of the latest Apple and Mac news. And I didn't find that show. And I thought, well, you know what? Everybody's saying that you can do your own podcast. You can start it up. And so I thought, since there was a need, I was looking for something that other people might be looking for something similar. So I started the show. I was going to do 10 minutes a day and kind of synopsize the latest Mac and Apple news stories. And I started out doing that. And what immediately happened was I started getting feedback. I started having people email me and ask me questions. They said, oh, you're a Mac guy. You know, I've been having this trouble with my Mac, or I'm looking for software to do that. And I realized real quickly, because I had been involved with Mac user groups, that was a lot of the kind of thing that was provided by your local Mac user group, and still is. And I'm still a member of my Mac user group, and I love that personal interaction, being able to go and to talk to people. But not everybody has access to that, and some people prefer to be on, you know, online. It's easier and more accessible to get to that information and content. So that's why it's genesis into sort of this two-part show where we still run down the news and the latest stories and stuff like that. But then the real, what I consider the meat of it, is that all that community stuff, the emails that you send me and the audio comments, and when we get to get down and dirty and really talk about Mac stuff. So that's why the MacCast is what it is today, and it's through the efforts of all of us, and it's great to be able to do this show for you each and every week. And now that I'm doing it, you know, full-time for the most part, still supplementing a little bit here and there, but the membership program, if you want to check that out, member.maccast.com, you can sign up and support the show directly. And we're making a go of it, and I think we can make it happen, and I'm looking forward to another 6 years with you, so thank you. We do have a lot of Mac and Apple stuff to get into today, so I want to dive into that. But before we get started, I have an exciting announcement from one of our sponsors. You know that Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook, have been a great friend and sponsor to the MacCast over the years, and they have great software for the Mac for taking notes and organizing your thoughts and ideas and stuff like that. I've raved about the Notebook product, and I love it. I use it. But many of you have been asking, when are they going to have an iPad version? I really want this on my iPad. Well, today is the day they have an iPad version. Actually, a couple days ago, they came out with their iPad version. Notebook for iPad is available on the App Store. You can go get it right now. It has all the great features and functionality you've come to love about Notebook, but completely rethought for the iPad. So it's got stickers and checkboxes and due dates and diagrams, charting, all the drawing tools are in there. You can sketch, you can draw. It really is like a physical notebook on your iPad. It's got the sticky notes and the flags, everything that you're going to want in there, but completely rethought for a touch interface, because with the iPad, you do have to do things a little bit differently. So one thing I would recommend is go to circusponies.com after you get the application and watch their video tutorials, because the interface is a little bit different. I got on there and I started to try and treat it like the desktop version. Well, you can't do that. Things are slightly redesigned. all the functionality is there, but you just need to get familiar with the controls. And they also include a great how-to guide when you download the app. And within a few minutes of using it and going through those tutorials, you know, 5-10 minutes, I was able to get really pretty comfortable with the basics, and then I'm starting to dive into some of the more advanced features. And what's great is there's full integration. I knew that was kind of important for them, that you'd be able to take your notebook documents from the iPad and bring them over to the desktop, and vice versa. Has support for, you know, embedded images and PDF documents, and the multi-dex is in there, completely implemented on the iPad. So you're going to be able to get stuff back and forth. You move things through iTunes, so through the standard iTunes, you know, application, copy, paste, I don't know what to call that thing. You need file management through iTunes. The one thing you want to make sure that you do is you do update to the latest version of the desktop app if you're going to be moving between the desktop and the iPad. Notebook version 3.0 445 is the build number. I had version 3.7.0 and things weren't working quite right. I found out you have to update to the latest version. So just be aware of that when you grab the app. But once you've done it, it works beautifully, and its notebook on the iPad has voice annotations, all that stuff. It's really, really cool. I'm having fun with it. Haven't played around with it a ton yet, but it is out there and available. So if you've been waiting on that, go pick it up. It's on the App Store, $29.99 US. You can also check out at circusponies.com when you're looking at the tutorials, the desktop version, if you don't have that yet. So pick that up. Free demo available of the desktop version. And a big thank you to Circus Ponies for their continued support of the MacCast. So let's dive into the news. Lots of things happening in the Apple Mac universe. It looks like the MacBooks may be getting some new graphics in the next update. This is at least according to CNET. They're reporting that Apple has decided that Intel's latest integrated graphics processing units, might be good enough for at least the 13-inch MacBook Pro, it's looking like. Intel has been expected to announce their Sandy Bridge processors. That's the code name for their latest CPUs. And they combine a GPU and a CPU into one 32-nanometer piece of silicon. So they're actually in the same piece of silicone, which is a little bit different from the prior integrated processors, the ones that we're familiar with. In the prior integrated designs, they actually had separate chips inside the same chip package, but in this case, it's going to be all in the same chip, so that's kind of the difference. Higher-end models of Apple's MacBook Pros would still use discrete GPUs, but there's also a rumor that they may move back to using what used to be the ATI processors. Apple's been bouncing back and forth between ATI and NVIDIA. NVIDIA's kind of been the latest GPUs we've been seeing. But now AMD had acquired a little while back ATI, and the rumor is Apple might move to the new latest and greatest AMD chips, some of the Radeon designs that were just announced. So we're going to have to wait a little while more later on when we might be seeing upcoming MacBooks from Apple. But looks like NVIDIA might be out. There was some rocky stuff between Apple and NVIDIA lately. Some of the bugs and things like that affected the MacBook. So I don't know if that is playing into Apple's decision, but CNET says we might see a move in the next update to the MacBook Pro line. A new update came out for the Apple TV 2. It was updated to iOS version 4.1.1. In the update, they addressed an issue that could cause some high-definition televisions to display incorrectly at the 480p resolution rather than, I guess, 720p. I don't know. I think this impacts the older HD TV sets. So if you were having issues with one of those in terms of the resolution, you're going to grab this latest 4.1.1 update for your Apple TV 2. The update also did address an issue that could cause movie or TV shows to be re-downloaded. I'm assuming that means sort of restarting the streaming, since the Apple TV 2 doesn't actually download TV shows or movies. And then some early reports from Apple Insider are saying that, unfortunately, it doesn't fix some of the HDMI handshake issues that people had been having with their Apple TV 2s. This is an issue that caused inverted colors or like solid color images to kind of show up on certain sets. That hasn't been resolved, unfortunately, and there's actually a 35-page discussion thread on Apple's forums about this, so it's not a minor issue if you're being impacted by it. Unfortunately, this wasn't resolved in this latest update. Not sure why, but hopefully they'll address that sometime soon. It's looking like the holidays might turn out to be very nice for Apple, at least according to the NPD group. In their latest numbers, they're predicting that Apple is going to beat their quarterly Mac sales records once again. They're predicting Apple will sell 4.1 to 4.3 million Macs in the last quarter of 2010. They're citing the new MacBook Air as a significant contributing factor to those Mac sales. I know those MacBook Airs are flying off the shelves. I've talked to a couple people at the Apple retail stores, and they say it's been a very popular model, getting rave reviews in the press, and people are just loving them. Everybody I know who's picked up a new MacBook Air is just over in the moon about it. And as Steve Jobs said, this is sort of the future vision for Apple when it comes to their notebook line. So I would imagine when we do see those updated MacBooks and MacBook Pros, they're going to be taking some of their cues. I think specifically a lot of stuff in the area of the SSD and solid state memory options coming forward, allowing Apple to have a little bit thinner designs and things like that. The Wall Street Journal, D All Things Digital blog, is also noting that right now, U.S. Mac sales seem to be up about 20% year over year for the first 2 months of the quarter, and international Mac sales are doing even better, up by their estimates 22 to 28% over the last 2 months. So certainly Apple doing very well in the Mac space, and I think beating most of the PC industry averages right now in terms of computer sales. When Apple announced the Apple TV 2, one of the technologies that I was most excited about was the AirPlay technology, and specifically AirPlay Video, which would allow you to stream a video directly from an iOS device or a Mac to the Apple TV. I thought that was going to be something that I was going to find very useful, specifically for third-party applications. Unfortunately, Apple's launched the technology, and it's available, but in a limited capacity. It really only works with Apple's own video applications, so the video app on the iPad and the iPod app playing videos on the iPhone and the iPod Touch. And then I think it also works with the YouTube app. I'm not even certain that it works with Safari, unless that's something that came in the latest update. I haven't actually gone back to test that, but definitely very limited in terms of how it works. And Erica Sadoun over at the unofficial Apple weblog, she's one of their bloggers, and she's also an incredible iPhone programmer and hacker. She has been playing around with the technology since it was released, actually figured out a way to, on a jailbroken device, get third-party video apps to be able to stream over AirPlay Video. But most recently, this week, she reverse-engineered the whole thing. She figured out a way to actually be able to send video from an iOS device, an iPad, iPod Touch, or an iPhone directly to a Mac, and even made a very alpha version of the Mac video app available for free. I'll have a link to it in the show notes. She's calling it AirPlayer. And I tried it out. I didn't get, there were two versions on her site, and they were just labeled 0.0.1. That version did work for me. There was also one called 0.0.1-32B, and I realized now that maybe the 32B stands for 32-bit, so maybe that's for older Macs. I have a newer Intel Mac. But once I had the software running, it's pretty simple. You run the software, you flip a button, it turns it on, and then suddenly your iOS device running AirPlay will recognize your Mac as a source to send video to. So it creates and advertises a custom Bonjour AirPlay service that essentially pretends to be an Apple TV. It makes your Mac look to your iOS device like it's a new Apple TV too. And it's pretty cool and a lot of fun to play with. So, you know, AirPlay definitely has some great possibilities. I think Apple is working on a lot of stuff. They're going to want everything to be completely bulletproof and work exactly right. I'm sure they're going to make APIs available for third-party developers to roll into their applications, and we'll start seeing some updates from those third-party apps allowing the AirPlay Video technology to work. But until then, we've got people like Erica and some of the other hackers playing around with it, and we get to have some stuff to play with. So if you'd like to check that out, grab it from her website. It's kind of fun. Apple Canada has finally been granted approval under the Investment Canada Act to sell iBooks on the iBook store. I saw this story and I was like, I thought you Canadians already had iBooks available. And it turns out that you did. Apple has actually had iBooks in the Canadian iBook store for a while, but I guess no titles from Canadian offers. Apple launched the service mostly with public domain books, and then on Canada Day, back on July 1st, they started adding U.S. titles to the bookstore. Apparently, there was a review going on by the Investment Canada Act, or under the Investment Canada Act, and now with the approval, Apple has agreed to promote Canadian-authored books, both French and English versions of the titles in the iBook store in Canada, as well as other iBook stores and the other international iBook stores. They also need to provide increased opportunities for Canadian publishers and authors, including new and independent writers. They need to provide increased access to titles from Aboriginal authors and publishers, and offer assistance to Canadian publishers in streamlining the ebook creation process and creating enhanced ebooks. And then finally, they had to agree to create jobs for Canadians and improve services for Canadian consumers, including creating a tailored version of the iBook store for Canadian readers. So I guess because of all of that, the Canadian iBook store is going to be actually run by Apple Canada, which is a subsidiary of the U.S. company. And by agreeing to do all of that, then under this act, Apple is able to put out Canadian or books from Canadian authors on the iBook store. So I think that started to happen already. If you're up and up there in Canada, just to the north of us, hey, send me an email. Let me know if you're starting to see some of those books show up. Unrelated, but also this week with the iBooks and the iBook store, Apple released iBooks 1.2 for iOS devices. It adds new full color illustrations. The last version did still have books with images in them, but this is more like picture books for kids. So they added a whole new kids books section. And so it's where you have, you know, full screen, full color images with text kind of overlaid on top of it. If you have tried out the iBooks app, you know that Apple included the Winnie the Pooh book for free, and that has illustrations, but the illustrations sit in between the text rather than having the text overlaid on top of it. So I guess that's the difference with the full color illustrations. They also added the ability to have collections, sort of like little bookshelves, and they separated PDFs and books into their own little sections. So what happens is, when you go into the app, you'll see a new collections button. If you click on that, you can switch between looking at your book collections and your PDF collections by hitting a little checkbox. And then under that, there's a button to add new collections, almost like new bookshelves. And each one goes under each section. So you can create categories under books or categories under PDFs. And then once you have those set up, you can move books and PDFs between those different shelves and then swipe on the screen left or right to move between your different collections. So that's going to, I think, help people with larger book collections organize them on the iOS devices. They also added AirPrint support, which for books means you can actually print and email your notes. So if you take notes in your books, I think it's going to be extremely helpful for textbooks and for students and stuff like that. You can do that. You can also print your PDFs directly from your iOS device to AirPrint supported printers, which currently is a limited set of HP printers that use their ePrint technology. But if you get the application AirPrint Hacktivator, which is a free app that you can find online, or the one I'm using is Printopia from Ecamm, $9.95 US for that. It has a lot of great features for doing AirPrint. I can actually AirPrint directly to my Mac as a PDF or directly to my Dropbox. Those are two extra features that the Ecamm software has that the Hacktopia software doesn't have. So either of those solutions allow you to do the AirPrint with the new iBooks 1.2. And then they also added an auto hyphenation feature, which helps you get more text on the screen, especially useful if you're using an iPhone or an iPod Touch for reading your iBooks. It's going to auto hyphenate and you won't have big gaps and spaces. So it really makes sure you get a full screen full of text as you're reading. So if you have iBooks, make sure that you run your app update, or you can grab the software on Apple's App Store. So I, you know, I didn't even realize this, but I guess we've had iAds. Apple's iAd program was something that came out with the release of iOS 4, and we've been seeing them. Developers have been using them on their iPhone apps for a while now. I guess I had never really noticed that iAds weren't available on the iPad, but this week Apple and Disney collaborated on and released the very first iAd for the iPad platform for the new Tron Legacy movie, which I think comes out tomorrow on the 17th, December 17th. But this is the very first iAd for iPad and is going to be the only one through the end of the year. It features 10 minutes of video. I was playing around with it. One thing is, it's really hard to find. I kept reading the blog posts and everybody was saying, oh, the new Tron Legacy ad for iPad, it's really cool. It's got all these extra features. I wanted to see it, and none of the articles were pointing out where you could find it. So it, actually, the one place I know it is and was able to figure out is in the TV Guide app. So if you download the free TV Guide app, you'll see the Tron Legacy iAd on the iPad if you want to see it. And it has 10 minutes of extra video, images from the movie, something that I thought was cool. And I guess this has always been there in iAds. I never noticed it before. But you can actually save the images as wallpaper or directly to your iPhoto library. So you just tap a button, you stay in the app, and it automatically saves it. It has a location-based theater locator. So if you want to find showtimes near you, runs with the Google Maps and uses your location to find stuff. Preview of the movie soundtrack with options to buy the music directly from within the application. The music for the movie is being done by Daft Punk, and there's actually a music video also available inside the iAd. It's designed, Apple put it out, and it's designed to kind of show off the capabilities and show other potential advertisers what they can do on the platform. And I have to say, it's a pretty good technical overview, although it did crash a couple times on me on my iPad, so it may be a little bit alpha. The interesting thing about the crashing of the iAd was that it crashed the ad, but then dropped me right back into the application. So that was good. At least it didn't take out the whole app. But it's going to be exclusive through the 2010. That's going to be the only iAd you're going to see on the iPad. You can get it through the free TV Guide app. And then I saw a news story this week from out of Europe that Unilever is going to be launching their iAds for European iOS devices. I couldn't tell by the news stories, and maybe you can tell me, I couldn't tell if this means this is the first iAd that's going to show up in Europe, or just the fact that Unilever or Apple had made a big deal about Unilever being one of the early adopters of the iAd platform, and that they're finally launching their ad campaign in Europe. Either way, it's going to be for their Lynx line of products. It's a line of men's fragrance products known as Axe in the US and in France, some other countries, and the campaign is going to be called Lynx Effect. So that should be showing up on an iOS device near you, meaning an iPhone or an iPod Touch. I generally like to know what you think of iAds. I've played around with a couple of them, mainly for research purposes, though. This is what I'm wondering. I'm wondering how effective they are just in general. When you're in an app, have you clicked on an iAd? I haven't done it beyond, well, that's not true. One or two of them I have actually clicked on just because I thought they were interesting and I wanted to see them. I guess maybe being an Apple Mac geek, I'm more responsive to Apple's iAds because the experience really is cool. I think they are different than some of the other ads. I've tried clicking on some of the ads from AdMob and some of the other networks, and while some of those are doing similar things, leaving you in the app and letting you experience some of the ad content, they just don't seem to be as interesting an experience when you actually get in there and play with them. Like the Tron Legacy thing was almost like having a little mini app inside your app. and playing around with that. I don't know also how developers are feeling about that. If what happens when Apple, if Apple's iAd content is better than the content that is in the original application, that could be a bad thing too. But I think overall, I'm really liking the experience with iAds, and the fact that it doesn't take you completely out of the application is really nice, even though some of the other competitors are doing that. But just visually, I find it more appealing. So I'm curious to hear your opinion. I'm not sure about you, but I'm noticing these days that I'm starting to put more and more of my content up into the cloud, and I'm kind of getting more and more comfortable with it. I had originally been a little bit hesitant about putting files and documents and things in the cloud. And now with Dropbox, I'm starting to use Dropbox a lot more for a lot of my applications. And with my iOS devices, just not having that much onboard storage, but still wanting access to files and documents and stuff like that, it's becoming something that interests me a lot. And I think it's something that is really interesting. Apple, this week, the Cult of Mac reported that they have exclusive details that Apple is working on and testing an initiative that would allow you to have your entire home folder living in the cloud, or at least the major pieces of it. They say a system is being developed for use with the new iPhone 5, which is rumored to have this near field communications technology. That's the kind of thing, like if you have a credit card with a little chip embedded inside of it where you can tap to pay, that's near field communications. It's RFID kind of technology. And supposedly the next iPhone is going to have that kind of technology integrated to allow you to do something like if you have your iPhone in your pocket and you walk up to your Mac, it could automatically authenticate you and log you into the system. This would work very similarly, except you'd be able to walk up supposedly to any Mac that supported this technology, had the near field communications technology, and I would imagine it would be something that would be part of OS 10 Lion 10.7, which is due out in the summer, along with the new iPhone, the iPhone 5. And it would allow you to put portions of your home folder into the cloud, and then when you walked up to that Mac, it would have things like your desktop and your settings, and you'd have access to your files. It wasn't really clear. There wasn't a lot of details given on exactly how everything would be managed, and there are some challenges when it comes to media files and photos and stuff like that. Specifically, the article pointed out that the labels have restrictions on streaming music to computers that the customer doesn't own. So they're kind of okay with it when it's already on your own computers and you're streaming music from and to your own computers and devices. But apparently, if you were to just walk up to any Mac and it had this technology enabled, the idea behind it would be you'd have access to all of your music library. Well, that's not the Mac that you own, and I guess there's restrictions in terms of the licensing from that regard. Also, they're looking at possible solutions that would take that out of the equation. One of the things mentioned in the article would be that you already have your music and your photos, or a lot of them, on your iOS device, so they could potentially just stream or give you access to the documents wirelessly from your phone. Another idea would be that you'd have access to your photos and documents and stuff like that stored back on your home Macintosh through services like Back to My Mac, or maybe even Mobile Me and your iDisk. So anything living on those in those areas could be accessible from that. What would you call that? Not really remote Mac. It's host Mac that you walk up to, and then also applications. You're just moving the home folder, but you might have applications that you need to work with. Somebody pointed out in the comments on the article that with the new Mac App Store, and I thought this was pretty clever, it could work in a lot of ways like iOS apps do. So Apple has a record. They know what applications you own and have paid for. They could potentially allow you to re-download those applications on the host Mac that you're working with temporarily and authenticated with through your iPhone, re-download those apps and temporarily install them on the home system, and then it's going to detect when you leave or walk away. It could automatically clean up after itself and remove those applications, and that could be pretty neat. So, we're kind of moving into that world of thin client computing, I guess you might call it. It seems a little bit like going back in time, back to the old days where you just had a centralized area. And Apple's been actually working on this kind of technology, and experimenting with it for a while. Some of you who are familiar with macOS 10 Server might know that they always had this idea of these server home folders. So an IT department could set up on the server all of their user accounts, and then people just from their Macs, when you'd log in, you'd log into your home folder through the server, and then all your stuff would be there. And it wouldn't matter what Mac you walked up to in the organization, anyone connected to the LAN and connected to the server could potentially be, quote unquote, your Mac, right? So Apple's been working on the technology. They might be moving it into the cloud and making it available, I would imagine, through some sort of Mobile Me style service or something linked with the next generation iPhone. So we'll probably find out this summer if it's something that's ready for prime time or if Apple still needs to work on it a little bit more. The rumor bees started buzzing earlier this week, wildly buzzing that Apple was partnering up with Toshiba to build a new plant for supplying low-temperature polysilicon, or LTPS, displays for iOS devices. Toshiba came out really pretty quickly and denied that Apple was involved with anything other than being a customer for Toshiba, and I think that's where these rumors kind of started. Toshiba is building a brand new plant that would be set up for producing that sort of display, but then could also be quickly converted to produce AMOLED displays. I never know whether to, and maybe somebody who knows something about display technology can tell me, is it AMOLED or is it AMOLED displays? I've heard it pronounced both ways by different tech journalists and things like that, so I'm not really sure what the proper is. Maybe you can do it either way. But Toshiba is building this new plant, and it's designed for these smaller to mid-sized displays for tablets and smartphones. Toshiba Mobile Display is one of Apple's LCD suppliers, so I think when everybody looked, oh, they're building a brand new plant, it's going to be mostly for screens, probably mostly for iOS devices for Apple, then naturally, the rumor becomes, well, Apple and Toshiba are building the plant together. Well, maybe a lot of Apple's money is going into the funding of the new plant, which is probably exactly what's happening. There really is, I guess, high demand, mostly from Apple, for these small to mid-size LTPS displays. Some of the other competitors are using different display technology, but it's pretty well thought that even the next generation iPad, the iPad 2, is going to use an LTPS display with the in-plane switching, the typical display that we see on the iPad, although it probably is going to be a higher resolution display, or at least a higher pixel density display, something more in that Retina display range. We've had a debate about this on the We Have Communicators podcast. Both Jeff Gamet and myself don't really think that Apple can bump up to a true 326 pixel per inch Retina display on a 9-inch tablet screen, because everything's going to end up looking really small at that resolution. And I'm not that old, folks, you know, I'm already having a hard time reading some of the text on my display. I guess you always have the option to zoom in and zoom out, or at least with most applications. Have you noticed that not every application allows that? And some of them, it's really frustrating, even in the current resolution. So I can't even imagine if they, you know, make that high resolution of a display that it's going to be workable. Because in essence, when you pack that many pixels in, what you're going to end up with is look at an Apple Cinema display, a 30-inch Cinema display. The resolution of that, you're going to have that same resolution crammed into a 10-inch screen. So that gets stuff really tiny. Even 12-point type at that resolution starts to become really small, and it would involve having to really kind of change user interfaces in a lot of apps. So I'm not sure Apple can do that. Either way, it sounds like Toshiba is going to be continuing to supply panels for Apple, and they're going to have a brand new plant to do it from. If you buy music through the iTunes store, and let's be honest, what Mac fan doesn't? You may have noticed earlier this week that there are now longer song previews. Apple had warned the record labels a while back that they were going to be switching the iTunes store to do 90-second audio previews on all tracks over 2 minutes and 30 seconds, and they held true on their promises this week, and we now have longer song previews. So if you didn't catch that, you might want to check that out on iTunes. It's actually nice because you can actually hear more of the lyrics, and in some cases, do you ever listen to a 30-second preview and it was just kind of the intro to the song and it never really got to the melody? So you really couldn't get a good feel for that song. So I think that's going to help with the purchases. The other thing is that Apple pushed some new updates to Ping So if you're a Ping user, I did an episode of the MacCast member program where I talked about some of the new Ping features and some of the things that I'm liking and how I'm finding it a little bit more useful now. But the two major features they added were integration for Twitter, so you can actually find new Ping followers through your Twitter list, the people who follow you or you follow on Twitter, and then also Ping playlists, so you can now share playlists along with your music purchases and stuff like that. And if you were an iMix user, if you ever used iMixes, you can actually convert your iMixes over to playlists. So some people had noticed, I saw on the Apple discussion boards right before they did this update, a bunch of people noticed that their iMixes were no longer available from their iTunes account, and that's why they're converted over into Ping playlists. So play around with that if you haven't caught it. Apple also did just push an update to iTunes. iTunes 1.1.1 was released. It has a number of fixes in it, including addressing an issue where some music videos might not play on Macs with NVIDIA GeForce 9400 or 9600 graphics. Fixed an issue where iTunes might unexpectedly quit when you were deleting a playlist and had the iTunes sidebar showing. It fixes an issue on some PowerPC Macs where iTunes unexpectedly quit when you were connecting an iPod, and then addressed an issue where some music videos might not sync to your iPod, iPhone, or iPad. So if you've been suffering any of those issues, make sure that you run your software update and grab iTunes 10.1.1, or you can download the latest version through Apple's support website at apple.com/support. And then lastly in the news for this week, we got a couple odds and ends. If you're an owner of a 27-inch LCD cinema display, there's a new firmware update available, firmware update 1.0, that fixes an issue with audio. Apparently, on some of those displays, audio was dropping out, so grab that. If you're a 27-inch cinema display owner, there is a rumor came in late as I was prepping the show that Apple has some new MacBook Pros and potentially a new iMac ready to go in the first half of 2011. This is coming out of DigiTimes. They're citing their upstream suppliers as the source for this rumor. Four upgraded MacBook Pro models, supposedly in line with a slight case redesign. No more details given than that. And on the new iMac, they say it's going to be a new panel size. No words on specifically what size that unit would be. And also a new price point. The news article does mention Lion. So when they say first half of 2011, I would expect they're meaning late in the first half of 2011, because Lion isn't due out until the summer. So I'm thinking maybe around the June timeframe when we might see those new models, if you're going to believe the DigiTimes report. And DigiTimes has historically been kind of hit or miss on their Apple rumors, so I take that stuff with a grain of salt. Definitely Apple's working on new models. When we'll actually see them, you never really know. And then finally, Apple announced a release date for the Mac App Store. It's going to open up on January 6th. They're telling developers to get ready and get their apps submitted by then. It's going to launch in 90 countries with both free and paid apps, and have one-click purchasing of applications using your Apple ID, and you'll be able to use your purchased apps on all of your Macs without paying any additional licensing or buying any additional copies. So just like iOS, you can install on multiple devices once you've made your purchase. That is one feature that I'm not sure developers are going to be completely happy with. It's almost like you get family pricing or the family licensing for free or without paying any additional cost. So I don't know if we'll see developers kind of adjust their application prices to account for that, or what's going to happen. It's going to be really interesting. Another nice feature, though, of the new Mac App Store is, just like apps on iOS, all of the updates are going to be delivered directly through the Mac App Store app. So you're not going to have to do any hunting around, or it's not going to have to be when you launch the app. It will tell you. I'm sure that's still going to be there in individual apps, but you're going to have that one-stop place to go and see all of your apps that need to be updated and kind of handle that all at once. And I would imagine it's going to handle the installing, launching the installers, and updating the apps as well. But we will know more come January 6th, because that's when we're going to be able to get our hands on the new Mac App Store. And that wraps up the news for this week. Before we move on, I want to thank another one of our show sponsors, Citrix, makers of GoToAssist Express. you know what? You know what's going to happen, right? You're going to get that call Christmas morning. You're going to be opening your gifts, doing whatever you do that day and having a good time. And phone's going to ring and it's going to be your brother, your uncle, your sister, your friend, whoever. They've got a new PC, they've got a new Mac, and they've got a problem. And you're the tech support, and they want you to help them. And you know it's going to be this long call, unless you can maybe just get in there and do it yourself, or actually show them how to do it so the next time they don't call you back. And there's no better way to do that than with GoTo Assist Express. And you can try it free for 30 days by going to GoToAssist.com/MacCast. If you sign up now, you got a 30-day trial, so you're going to be ready on Christmas morning when that call comes in. And it's really simple and easy. Once you have the app installed, when they call you up, you're just going to launch the GoTo Assist software. You're going to get a link. You send them that link. You can do it via email. You can tell them over the phone a code and tell them a website to go to. They can enter the code into, or however, you get them the link. They click on that, and in a few seconds, it will download and install the client software they need on their computer. It'll happen automatically. All they really have to do is accept the software. And then in minutes, you'll be able to remotely control their screen. You're going to be able to see what's on there. You're going to be able to get an analysis of everything that's running on their system, how much RAM they have, what applications they're running, what is going on, make the assessment, and do the repair, all without having to get out of your pajamas. It's really cool, and they make it just so easy. And when you're all done, guess what? The software will uninstall itself from their computer, so that you're not going to have them wondering, you know, what do I need to install? You're not going to have to deal with opening up firewall supports. It works over standard protocols. You're not going to deal with router configuration that a lot of the other solutions for doing remote access kind of make you go through. And it does it all securely. It uses 128-bit SSL and SRP encryption technology, so you don't have to worry about anything from that side. And even when you sign up for the free trial, they will remind you before it expires. So you don't have to worry about, you know, some charge showing up. You can try it out, not have to worry about it. And if you don't want to do that and you still get that phone call, they have day passes available. So for like $10 for that day, you can have a full day of access. You can help everybody you need to for that day. And then you have no contract. So either way you go, it is a great service. I've used it, and it works out really nicely. GoToAssist.com/MacCast for your free 30-day trial. And a big thank you to Citrix for their support of the MacCast. So probably the biggest story of the week this week was not an Apple story, not a Mac story, but just a tech story. And it was the Gawker hack. I'm talking about the Gawker Media hack, where hackers made off with all of their passwords for their different websites. And if you don't know who Gawker Media is, they run the websites Lifehacker, Gizmodo, and a bunch of others. And if you'd ever signed up for to make a comment on any of those sites, you probably had a Gawker account, and it probably did get compromised. There's actually services you can go online now, and you can find sites that'll allow you to search that database to see if your account got compromised. And I was one of the lucky people who did have a Gawker account and whose password did get hacked. And the reason it did is because it was one of the few websites that I hadn't updated using 1Password. I think I've talked about this on the show in the past, but I thought this was a perfect opportunity to bring up again why I am a 1Password user. And what was nice about being a 1Password user is when this happened, I was able to quickly go into 1Password and see all of the sites that I still had this password on. And I need to give you a little bit of history, I guess, to my password methodology, and also explain that this is one of those situations that I think we all get into a lot, like backup, right? You don't do anything. You know you're supposed to do backup. But it usually takes some sort of catastrophic event, unfortunately takes some catastrophic event for a lot of us to happen before we realize and we get that kick in the pants to go, yep, okay, now I'm actually going to do what I should have done 3 months ago. And I guess this is a little bit of a cautionary tale, because I'm saying don't be like me and don't get yourself in the situation of, yeah, I know I should do it, but it's too much of a hassle. You make excuses, right? It's going to be too hard. I don't want to have to remember all these hashed passwords. I don't want to have different passwords on every website. What happens? I mean, there's a million excuses, and I did this. And I became a 1Password user about a year and a half ago because of another hack. I had my Yahoo account hacked. And so I had in the past been using what I called this three-tier system, where I would evaluate the website I was signing up for an account on and try and determine what information does this website have and how vulnerable am I if my account on this site was going to get hacked. So in the case of Gawker, the only thing that you have access to through my Gawker account is the ability to post on the Gawker websites. There was no personal information stored there. I didn't store an address or a phone number or any kind of banking information, credit card number. So I thought, okay, well, I'll just use my least secure password for the site. And thus why when the database got stolen, my account got hacked and they got access to my password. The problem with that thinking, and was readily apparent when the Gawker hack happened, is that I had that same password on a few other sites. And when I got one password, one of the things that I should have done is gone through every single site and updated all of my passwords. I went through every single site through my Medium, what used to be in my old system, my Medium and Strong passwords, and changed them all. But I didn't really, I was still kind of working through the process and had not gotten to all of the websites with this sort of least secure password. And again, when I originally created that, my thinking was, well, there's no real important information on here. But one of the ones that I missed was my LinkedIn account. And there is some stuff in there that is pretty critical. And more importantly, LinkedIn also had some integration with Twitter. And Twitter recently changed their authentication scheme to use this new technology called OAuth. And actually, Twitter's solution isn't a pure OAuth solution. So those of you who are shouting at me right now who are tech savvy and know, Twitter didn't do, they kind of did their own implementation of OAuth, not the OAuth standard. Yeah, I know that. But the idea behind that is that when you have accounts that log into other accounts on your behalf, so like Twitter, so LinkedIn was linked to my Twitter account. With the new OAuth mechanism, what's nice is I was able to go into Twitter and remove that authentication, say LinkedIn can't use Twitter anymore. But unfortunately, I think they got through because I didn't realize that I had the same password on my LinkedIn account as I had on my Twitter account, at least not immediately. It took me a day or two. And so that's kind of vulnerability you open yourself up to when you're not using secure passwords. And it happened to me, and I'm saying to you, don't let it happen to you. So I had had this resistance to 1Password for the longest time, and then my account got hacked, and then I started using it. And now I see the light and I go, why didn't I do this sooner? Because it really is easy. So I wanted to explain the 1Password solution and let you know this is how it works. This is how simple it is to secure your passwords. So when you get 1Password and you install it, the application also installs a plugin for Safari, Firefox, Chrome, anything that you're going to, any browser that you want to use. And so you install 1Password and then you give it a single password that is going to be the password that you make. You make it a really secure password, so a long passphrase or whatever you need to do, a mixture of numbers, letters, symbols, upper and lowercase, do all of those things. You know, make this a bulletproof password, but that 1Password that you can remember, you don't write it down anywhere, you don't do anything with it but memorize it. And that is your 1Password. That is going to be the access to all of the other passwords and information that you're going to store inside 1Password. And 1Password uses Blowfish encryption. It is really safe and secure to store a file on your Mac with all this information in it. Or better yet, and one of the reasons why I'm a 1Password user is it has Dropbox integration. So I actually store that 1Password file in my Dropbox, but that file is encrypted and protected. So even if someone were to get to that file, they're not going to be able to get in and get access to that information without your 1Password, that 1 master password. And the only way someone's getting that from me is through torture. And if that's happening, I have bigger problems than someone trying, you know, bigger problems going on than someone just trying to get to my account information. But with that file stored on my Dropbox, it solved one of my things of resistance in moving to this kind of 1Password concept was that I thought, well, you know, what if I lose that file or I can't get access to it? Or what if I'm on some other device? Well, they have an app for your iOS devices. So I have it on my iPhone and my iPad, and everything syncs to that 1Password file. I have multiple Macs, so I can get at that information when and wherever I am. So even if I'm on a friend's Mac and I need a password, I can get it out of my iOS device. I can pull up the iPhone app and get access to that. And all of that stuff is stored encrypted there as well. So if you lose your phone, you can put a passcode lock on it. You can put two or three different protections on it, and you don't have to worry about that data getting compromised. So that took care of that excuse for me. My second one was, oh, it's going to be a pain to have to always look up my passwords. Well, with the plugin, what happens is once you have your passwords and your login information stored, it'll recognize, if it's a web password, it'll recognize the website that you're on. And when you get to the login form, you just click the little 1Password icon up there in the toolbar, and it will automatically say, oh, you want to log in to Google. And you go, yeah, I want to log into Google. You click log into Google, and it will pop up, if you haven't already authenticated, ask for your 1Password password to give it access to the 1Password database, and then we'll automatically fill in the login for that website. So I don't know the logins for any of the sites that I visit, because I had 1Password generate all the passwords. And when you sign up for a new account, they even make it easy as well, because what you do is, when you're in the sign up form, when you get to the little password field, you can just control or right click in that area, and you can choose the 1Password option to generate a strong password. You can also do it from the toolbar item that the plugin installs. Either way, it doesn't matter. And then you generate a password, and it gives you all these great little sliders and parameters that you can set. So you can set the length and make it super long, 16, 20, 24 characters, mixture of upper and lower case, numbers, letters, symbols. And I will tell you, make sure that you include symbols. For me, I typically do a 16-character password with 2 numbers and 2 symbols. And the symbols are important because hackers have gotten sophisticated, and I've been doing a little bit of research on this since the Gawker news story released. Just having a long password that's upper and lowercase with numbers is not strong enough anymore, because they have these things called, I think they're called rainbow hash tables. And in essence, what hackers have done is they've gone through and already done the decryption and made these huge libraries that they can just match against. And a lot of those don't include numbers or don't include symbols, because as you get longer and longer, and as you add more characters and more variables, these files get larger and larger. And at a certain point, it's just not feasible with the computers and the technology we have to run through that volume of information. So that's what you're trying to get to. You're trying to get to a password that is just so hard to crack, because all passwords are crackable. That's the thing. Given enough time, right? Enough time and enough computing power. And so what you're trying to do is make it financially impossible, so they'd have to invest in a multi-million dollar computer system to crack your password, or just have it take so long with the current technology that they're able to afford or get access to, that it's just not worth it, or it's undoable. So that's how you make a password quote-unquote uncrackable. But 1Password allows you to do that pretty easily, because you don't have to remember this stuff. You just have it generate a password, and then once you've saved the account, it drops down a little box and says, would you like to save this to your 1Password database? You say yes. You give it a title so that you can recognize it when you come back later, and then you hit save. If you ever update your password, it will drop down that box again and say, do you want to save this or do you want to update the existing password? So it makes it easy to update your passwords. It makes you easy to generate the passwords, and it really does not impact you in terms of time. That was always my concern. It was going to be a big hassle to log in into every website. Now, I'm going to tell you, it's not as easy as just going to the website and typing in your username and password, the one that you use everywhere. But by adding a few extra seconds, I mean, literally, it takes a few seconds longer to log into the 1Password database and have it fill in that information, you are going to be kept a lot more safe and a lot more secure. So that was kind of my plea for you to use 1Password. Use this as, and use my bad example of getting hacked as your catalyst to go out and do that. And 1Password is the tool I use. There's some other great software services that are similar available for the Mac. Use any one of them. I don't really care. One of the things that I like about 1Password is it does allow me to put in other account information, so like my FTP accounts and my MySQL accounts, stuff like that. You can also store your software purchases in there, so you can keep track of your serial numbers, your product numbers. And that's really handy when you do the other tip that I've talked about and doing a clean install of your operating system. You already have all of your serial numbers and product information in one place. And again, it's secure. So if your Mac gets stolen or something like that, you don't have to worry about that information getting out there. So I like it for that. You can also store secure notes. And another tip is many of the websites will ask you, and this is a huge security hole, will ask you for a password reset question, right? What was the name of the high school you went to, or what's your pet's name? Well, that information people can find out, and they can use that to hack into your accounts. But what you can do is you could make up a completely bogus answer to that question, something that makes no sense. So when they say, what high school did you go to? You type Brussels sprouts. Well, you're going to need to be able to remember that. A good way to remember that is to put it into a secure note in 1Password. So I've done that on a couple websites, and I can just go to my secure note if I ever need to answer a password security question and go, okay, what answer did I give for this question? And that information is in 1Password and stored securely. So a very versatile application, one that has just been a godsend for me. And I know this probably sounds a little bit like an ad, but I just really don't want anybody to kind of suffer through what I have or be, in trouble when something like this happens with Gawker and your password information gets out there. So protect yourself proactively. Do something. Use this software or any other software that you want to use. And I just thought I'd explain why I am a 1Password user, and this is exactly the reason why. A while back on the Maccast, I talked about organizing your iTunes library, specifically some tips and tricks you could do for setting up automated playlists and playing around with your metadata and stuff like that. And one of the things I mentioned was using star ratings. And I had been going through some older voicemails and stuff like that, and I ran across this review that I somehow had missed from Robbie, but I think it applies and could be useful for some of you.
Hey, Adam. My name's Robbie, and I'm actually a little late. This is a comment for show number 311. I noticed you were talking about star ratings in iTunes, and I thought I'd share with you one of my favorite little tools. It's called AutoRate, and it actually takes into account how many times you've played a song, how many times you've skipped a song, and it auto-rates a song for you in your iTunes library. And it'll go through and do it for everyone automatically in like 30 seconds. And I feel like it actually gives a little meaning to those star ratings because I don't actually have to go through and do each one individually. And it's one of my favorite tools, and it's free. And you can find it at code.google.com/p/autorate. Well, I hope you like my tip. It's one of my favorite things. And I love the show. Keep up the good work, man.
Hey, thanks, Robbie. We always appreciate you sending in your product recommendations. I can't get to every application. There's some that I just have never run across, and I had not run across this AutoRate app. And I tried it out, and I have to say it's pretty good. Some settings you might want to play with if you're going to use the app. One thing I would recommend: backing up your iTunes library just in case you don't like the results, or you don't like what it does, because it is going to automatically go through and apply ratings to all of your tracks. So it's for a really specific purpose, and you just need to know going into it and have a backup in case you want to back out of it. But the other thing is you probably want to allow half star ratings, which I think makes it a little more useful because it can actually apply half star ratings, and that's not something that's enabled in your iTunes account, but by default. It does come with a little application when you download the app to allow you to turn on half star ratings. You can also turn on half star ratings using a terminal hack, or my favorite method for doing it, or what I think is the easiest way to do it, is to use another program I've mentioned on the Maccast before. It's a system preference pane called Secrets. And you can find that at secrets.blacktree.com. And I'll have links to both Secrets and the AutoRate app in the show notes at maccast.com as well. But worked as advertised. I ran it, and it goes through it, analyzes your library, and looks at the number of times you've played or skipped a track, and then uses an algorithm to apply a star rating. I did notice that there were some tracks that I had skipped a number of times on my iDevice, and that information does sync back to your iTunes library. So it is going to take that into account as well. So you're probably going to have to go through and do some cleanup, because it did mark some songs for me as like 1 star, 1.5 star rated songs that I wouldn't consider to be that, because it also looks at play counts. So if you have albums that you listen to more frequently, it's obviously going to rate those higher. But nice little tool. And if you've never used star ratings before, if you want to use them kind of in a different manner, you can use this at least as a starting point to get into star rating your stuff. So thanks, Robbie, for the recommendation. And I guess for whatever reason this week, I'm looking at the rest of the stories we have to get to, and or the rest of the things that we're going to talk about, and it's a lot of iTunes stuff. So that's kind of cool. It just always works out that way. It's really weird. But the next thing I wanted to mention was there were some stories this week about unwanted purchases or unwanted in-app purchases on iDevices, specifically parents, you know, downloading some software or buying an app on the App Store and then handing their iPad or their iPhone over to their kids. The kids play the game and then the game has in-app purchases. And I don't know if you're aware or not, but anytime you log into your Apple account, and this is going to become an issue, I would imagine, with the new Mac App Store as well, it caches or remembers that login or credentials for about 15 minutes. After that, and any additional purchases you make, it doesn't ask you to re-authenticate or re-put in your credentials. So this goes for in-app purchases on your iOS devices also. So when you hand it over to your kid or to somebody else and they're playing around on it and then they click on an in-app purchase, it pops up, says, do you want to make this purchase? You hit OK, boom, it's charging your card and it's purchasing without doing any additional login. So that's something you need to be aware of when you're using an iOS device. And also, it's pretty easy to make sure that you don't end up with these unwanted purchases. One way is just to make sure that you log out of your account after making your purchase. And you can do that manually from most of the App Store screens on your iPhone, your iPod Touch, or your iPad. All you have to do is in the iTunes app or in the App Store app, scroll all the way down to the bottom and you should see your logged in Apple ID, probably your email address. Click on that little button and then a dialog will pop up and you'll see an option to sign out. And you sign out of your account, and that way if you need to make a purchase again, it's going to force you to log back in. Or if you come back into the App Store app, you're going to have to log back in again. So you're just going to need to be aware of that. Little inconvenient, but if it avoids unwanted credit card charges, then that's probably a good thing. The other thing that you can do is enable parental controls on your iOS device, or Apple calls it restrictions now, I believe. So if you go into the settings of your iDevice and then go to general and then click on restrictions, you'll see a switch to enable the restrictions. Turn that to on, and then you can leave everything off except for if you go down. Oh, you do have to enter your passcode, I think, to enable the restrictions, first of all. So it'll ask you for your passcode. Enter that in, and then go down to the section that says in-app purchases, and flip that slider to off, and that will completely turn off in-app purchases. In order to turn them back on, you're going to have to enter your passcode. So the only thing with this method is that if you do actually want to make an in-app purchase, you're going to have to go back out to your settings and disable this feature or enable in-app purchases again to be able to do that. But another way to avoid unwanted charges or unwanted in-app purchases, especially if you have kids or other people who might be using your iPhone, iPad, or iPod Touch. Since there's a good chance that you're probably listening on iPhone, iPad, or iPod Touch, I'm guessing that you have seen the little 30-second skip back icon that shows up in the interface where you can click that little, looks like a 30-second rewind button, and it will jump back in the audio 30 seconds. And that's available for podcasts. It's also available for audiobooks, but it's typically not available for other types of audio and video files, which prompted this question from MacCast listener and fellow podcaster, Elsie.
Hi, Adam. This is Elsie from Elsie's Yoga Class Live and Unplugged podcast, and a huge fan of yours. I was wondering if you could help me out with a little something. I'm not sure if this is possible. My podcast is basically, I just record my live yoga classes and I post them. And part of my workflow is that I have to listen to myself and I provide in my show notes a sequence of the yoga poses that I do. Now, the classes run from like 60 minutes to 90 minutes. And there's plenty of times that I totally space out listening to myself and I have to go back and re-listen again so that I don't miss anything because I space out all the time. And so the thing is, though, with the files that I'm using when I'm listening to them on my iPhone, I don't have that little 30-second go back thing that you can do when you're listening to podcasts. So when I'm listening to these huge files, my finger just either goes back too far or not enough or goes forward. And I spend all this time just trying to figure out, all I need sometimes is just to go back 30 seconds. Is there a setting in iTunes where I can have that little go back 30 seconds thing when I'm listening to those files? Because that would so make my life so much easier. So anyway, that's my question. Thank you very much. Happy holidays. Bye-bye.
Happy holidays to you too. Yeah, you know what? There are a couple things that we can do here that I think will help you out. And one is actually give you that 30-second playback thing in files that are other than a podcast or an audiobook. And before we do that, though, I want to mention that the scrubbing backwards, so when you're listening to an audio file on your iPhone, your iPod Touch, your iPad, you can scrub it back by grabbing that little handle and sliding left or right, right? You can scrub through, and that's what you're talking about, I believe, when you say sometimes you just go too far, because that runs at a certain speed. Well, you can actually control how quickly or slowly that scrubbing happens, or how much of that scrubbing goes by when you're pulling your finger to the left or right, by simply clicking on that little handle, and then instead of dragging to the left or right to start your scrubbing, if you just slide your finger down, and it's a little bit weird because you're actually, once you've tapped the control and you've kind of grabbed that little handle, that little ball, and you start sliding your finger down, the ball is going to stay attached to the little scrubber line, but your finger is moving down the screen on your iPhone, let's say. And as you do that, what you'll notice is above the line, it'll start off, it'll say high-speed scrubbing. And the further your finger gets down the screen toward the bottom of your device, it'll move and it'll say half-speed scrubbing, and then quarter-speed scrubbing, and then fine scrubbing. And at whatever point you can start moving your finger to the left or right to do your scrubbing, and it will move along the scrubber line at that speed. So in your case, you probably, since you only need to go back about 30 seconds, you probably want to click on that scrubber, drag your finger all the way down till it says fine scrubbing, and then do your scrubbing back and forth. And that way you'll be able to hear more finely the point at where you want to stop, and you won't overshoot it. So that's one quick way that you can handle what you need to do. But more specifically, you're looking for that 30-second skip back. And as we've already determined, that's available in podcasts and audiobooks. And in your case, my guess is that you've recorded some audio. It's probably in MP3 or AAC or maybe WAVE format, AIFF, whatever you originally recorded it in. And when you put it into iTunes and sync it over to your device, it's probably coming in as a standard music track. And standard music tracks don't get the little 30-second rewind thing. But what you can do is you can take your track in iTunes, just like you thought, and tell iTunes to treat it like an audiobook or a podcast. So if you just select the track in iTunes and then choose Get Info, and then go to the Options tab in the screen that pops up, you'll see an option for Media Kind, and it will be probably set to music. Just change that to Podcast and click OK. Now, what'll happen is it will, once you've done that and clicked OK, it's going to move it from your main music library, and it's going to put it over in the podcast section. And I guess this is kind of a bonus tip. I've had some people who have asked, you know what, I just downloaded a podcast directly from someone's website. So you can go to the MacCast website, and you can go back all the way back, and you can get the original MacCast that I recorded, you know, 6 years ago. You can download that, but when you load it into iTunes, it's going to go into the standard music section. If you use this trick, you can actually get it to go back into the podcast section as well. And this works with the latest version of iTunes, and I think iTunes 9. I'm not sure it goes back much earlier than that. But all my tips for iTunes right now are referring to iTunes 10. So just change that to podcast. It'll go over to the podcast section. And then just make sure that you go into your device and you sync that as a podcast back to your device. And then you'll find it in the podcast section. And when you play it, you'll notice you have that 30-second skip back. You could also put it into the audiobook section if that's where you prefer to do it. But one of those two methods, I think, is going to get you the functionality that you want or need, Elsie. So thank you for the question, and happy holidays. All right. And then last for today is a series of iTunes related questions that I got from Franklin. He left me a voicemail. It's a little bit longer voicemail, so we're going to do this a little bit differently. I am going to play some of his question and then respond to it. And then we'll play some more just to kind of break it up a little bit. But he had a number of questions about iTunes, a growing library. It was kind of filling up his internal hard drive, and then questions related to external storage and how to manage all of that. And I get these questions a lot, so I thought this was worth covering for you.
Hey, Adam. My name is Franklin from Springfield, Missouri. I've listened to the show for over a year now, and the MacCast has become one of my favorite Mac-related podcasts, which seems to be what over half my podcasts are all about. And that's actually why I'm calling you about my podcasts. I had a few questions about external storage in iTunes. I was surprised tonight to see that the 500 gigabyte hard drive that I had installed in my iMac when I bought it new almost 3 years ago had only about 53 gigabytes left on it. I couldn't imagine where it had all went to, particularly when I figured a few weeks back that I had used about 60% of it. In a few short weeks, had I really used all but 10% of my hard drive? So I started poking around in my home folder. I went straight to my iTunes folder, remembering that I had downloaded close to 1,000 episodes of podcasts recently. I had missed a lot when I didn't have internet from August to the last part of November. And boy, was I surprised. My iTunes folder is 283 gigabytes in size. Music takes up 281 gigabytes, of which 211 gigabytes is nothing but podcasts. To compare, I have over 9,000 items in my iPhoto library, mostly photos with a few videos, and it's only about 40 gigabytes. I need another hard drive for my music, and I need it fast.
Okay, let's stop there. So, first problem, I think, is one that we all have, podcasts. If we subscribe to a lot of podcasts, they take up a lot of space, especially if you're doing video podcasts. And in your case, it sounded like you had some catching up to do, so you re-enabled podcasts and you had over 1,000 podcast episodes download. So really, I'm not sure you might need a new hard drive, and we're going to get to that in a second, but I think probably the first area to address is just podcast management or managing your podcasts. And iTunes has a bunch of really great features for doing that. So if you go into the podcast section of your library and you click on that podcast section, and in the main window, you scroll down to the bottom, there's a little button that says settings. Click on the settings button in the bottom of that main window, and that's going to bring up the options for managing your podcasts. You'll notice that there's an option for podcast defaults, a little drop down. It's set to podcast defaults by default, and then you might consider changing some of the settings that are in there. So there's a setting for when new episodes are available. You can tell it what to do, and one of the options is download all episodes. I'm guessing that's what you have it set to. I have changed mine to say only download the most recent episode. So even if I hadn't listened to a podcast for a while and hadn't picked up the latest episodes, it's only going to download the latest episode that's in the feed rather than doing all 1,000. And I'm going to tell you how to get the other episodes if you need to here in a minute. Because you can always come back and you know, download episodes one by one from the library using the little get option. Another setting you might consider changing in the defaults is how many episodes to keep. So one of the options is all episodes. If you have it set to keep all episodes, it's never going to delete anything from your library. But you can also have iTunes automatically delete older episodes or only keep a certain number of episodes. I like to have mine set to only keep the last 3 episodes, but you can set it to any value you want. Last 1, last 3, last 5, last 10 episodes, whatever you're going to be comfortable with. But you don't necessarily, unless you want to build an archive, you don't necessarily have to keep every single episode, because they're going to be available on the feed, on the website, online. You can go back and get individual episodes. If you don't want to rely on that, you might want to set it up so that it gives you a window where you can archive off old episodes, but then still let it auto-delete stuff. And again, I'm going to tell you how you can actually override these settings, because what you can actually do is, once you've set up the podcast defaults, you'll notice if you hit that drop-down, you can look at individual shows, and you can change the settings for those individual shows. So you can pick an episode like, or a show like the MacCast out of that list, and then uncheck the box that says use default settings, and then it will open up these additional options. And so you can have one podcast that maybe you keep all episodes for. So maybe you have your favorite tech podcast and you want to keep that as an archive. Well, you can override the default settings, but still let the default settings for the rest of the podcasts auto-delete those episodes. Another thing that you can do is you can actually go into the main podcast window and you can set the do not auto delete option. So even if you in the settings for your podcast defaults, you've set it to delete any episode beyond the last 3 episodes, you can go into an individual podcast, select it from the podcast list, and then control or right click on it. And in the contextual menu, you'll see an option that says do not auto delete. So you can specifically tell iTunes, okay, for this podcast, I don't want you to ever auto delete anything. And if you ever want to change that back later, you can come back, select the same podcast, control or right click on it, and set the allow auto delete option back on. Now, I told you I was going to mention how you can actually manually download episodes. So if you set the setting to only grab a certain number of episodes or a certain number of the latest episodes, and you somehow missed one, you know that if you come into the podcast list in iTunes, you will and expand out the list with that little disclosure triangle, the episode list, you'll see the episodes that you've downloaded, and they're going to be in black text. Any ones that are in the feed that haven't been downloaded are going to appear in gray, with a little get button next to the individual episode. You can just click on that to actually manually download an individual episode. Another thing is, if you're like me, I like to go in and I like to clean up my episodes, or say you listen to an episode and iTunes, for whatever reason, auto-deleted that episode, it's no longer in the list. You're only going to see the most recent stuff. You can actually get the full list of what's in the feed by holding the option key down and clicking on that little disclosure triangle. When you do that, it will fill in any of the episodes that are still in the feed but aren't on your Mac or aren't downloaded locally, and will give you those little get buttons again. A lot of people don't know that little trick. So that can help for downloading individual episodes. Another way is you can just stream episodes. Rather than store them on your Mac, you can go ahead and stream them right from the iTunes store. So if you go into the iTunes store and you search for MacCast and you hit play, you don't get the 30-second preview. You can actually stream the whole entire MacCast episode without even downloading. So that's another option for you for going back for an archive, where you won't have to take up hard drive space, but you can still listen to the episodes. And if you need to do it on your iOS device, it works with the iTunes app. On iOS devices, you can even play the audio in the background. You can stream it over 3G if you have the unlimited data plan. Be careful if you're on one of the newer limited data plans with the streaming directly on your iDevice. You want to be careful. Or you can use a third-party app like Podcaster or Stitcher Radio, which is like a streaming radio app for all kinds of podcasts. You can actually even set up your own channels of your favorite Mac or tech podcasts inside Stitcher Radio, and it'll stream them one episode to the next. So streaming is always an option if you're running low on storage space. But let's get to your questions about hard drives.
I have a mid-2007 24-inch iMac with a WDC 500 gigabyte hard drive and 4 gigabytes of RAM. My first question is, can I easily replace the internal 500 gigabyte hard drive myself with either a 1 or 2 terabyte hard drive? I'm not really hardware savvy, but it might be something that if it's easy, I might try. If not, could I take it to my local Apple reseller and have them replace the hard drive? I know on the iMacs, its upgrades are kind of a little iffy because of space-wise and everything.
So, yeah, you're going to want, with the iMac, it is a pretty tricky install process. It sounds like you're probably out of AppleCare, although that wouldn't really matter too much because you are allowed to replace your hard drive. The deal with AppleCare is that if you do your own repairs or your own maintenance, like swapping out a hard drive or putting in memory or something like that, any damage caused by you in that process would not be covered by AppleCare, but it still doesn't necessarily void your AppleCare. And certainly any new hardware, your new hard drive or new memory that's not Apple installed memory is not going to be covered by AppleCare. But in the case of the iMac, it is not an easy thing to get in and replace a hard drive inside an iMac. I actually tried to do it with a white G5 iMac that I had, and I broke a little temperature sensor that was connected to the hard drive and actually ended up having to take it to Apple and have them do the repair. So I ended up paying them to do the repair anyway. And they put the new drive in for me. So I would advise that you go to the Apple Store, have them install the drive for you, or go to your local Apple Authorized Service Center and have them do the install. Unless you really know what you're doing, you probably don't want to mess around too much with the swapping out the drive in an iMac.
My second question is, I'm looking to get a large external hard drive. And I'm seriously looking at the Western Digital MyBook hard drives in at least a 1 terabyte size and at least a FireWire 800 hookup. I've also seen that there are some out there that have a gigabit Ethernet hookup. I was wondering, are they a lot faster than the FireWire 800 and are they easy to connect? This could be an option since I'm connecting to the internet with an Airport Express router and I'm not using my Ethernet port right now. I've heard all good stuff about Western Digital in general, and specifically I've heard the MyBook hard drives are really good. Are they a good choice for this type of storage? Also, I'm looking at maybe getting one as a potential drive to back up to.
Okay. On brand, Western Digital should be fine. I don't have a lot of experience with Western Digital drives. I'm hit or miss on Western Digital. I like Seagate drives. I also like Toshiba and Hitachi on the laptop-sized drives. But any of those brands should be perfectly fine. The only one I personally avoid is MacStore, which is actually now Seagate. So my general rule of thumb is, as long as you get a drive that has at least a 3-year and possibly 5-year warranty on it, it's probably going to be a pretty good drive, at least from one of those brands that I mentioned. Some of the off brands or no name brands I typically just avoid, but that's just preference more than anything else. For your application, I'm curious, you mentioned FireWire. I don't know that you necessarily need a FireWire drive if you just plan on using it as a media or a backup drive. USB 2.0 is probably going to be fine, and you might be able to save a little bit of money. On the Ethernet, Gigabit Ethernet port interface, that's typically for a network drive, a network-attached storage drive. If you're not looking for that specifically, then again, I just go with a USB 2 drive connected right to your Mac. You also mentioned that you're not using the AirPort. If you have an AirPort Express or an AirPort Extreme base station, you could also hook a USB drive to that and use it as a network drive. So that is always an option, and you can certainly put your media over there. The other thing that you might think about when you're considering an external drive, especially since this is for an iMac, so maybe it doesn't matter as much, but if you have a portable, or if you ever think that you're going to need to take your music library with you, once you've moved your music library to an external drive, you're not going to have it when you're disconnected. So if you have a laptop and you don't take the drive with you, you're not going to have access to your music files or your media files, or at least not to your full library. There are ways you can create a subset of your library, and I'll mention a couple of those here in a second. But you might consider going with a 2.5-inch laptop laptop drive that's USB bus powered, so you can actually take it with you. That way you can grab it when you want to. And then you mentioned possibly using it for dual duty. You certainly can. You could use it for backup. You could use it for archive and file storage along with your media storage. But I actually, since hard drives are cheaper these days, I prefer to have separate drives for my backup versus my media and file storage. I do mix my media library, my iTunes library, along with other files. I use my external drive for both. But for Time Machine, for Super Duper backups, I have dedicated drives for those things. But again, that's just a personal preference. It's just the thing that if the drive goes out, you're going to, your backup's going to go along with your media files. But it's nothing more than that. There's not any more risk or anything like that. And you should be backing up all that stuff to other drives anyway. So just something to think about there. And a lot of people, you know, partition. I'm not big on partitioning these days. I don't really think it's necessary, but that's always an option. You could partition part as a backup drive and part as your media storage if you got a large drive or something like that.
I've also heard on the typical Mac user, and I think also on the Maccast, that sometimes whenever you take files out of some of the iLife program files, like iTunes, like iMovie, that it can cause problems. So if I did want to put these on an external drive, how would I move these music and podcast files without messing everything up in iTunes and the way it works? I really love iTunes and my iPods. I really don't want to break that system. And also, I think external storage is the way that I want to handle this problem, but I was wondering if there was another option that you could think of. There's a lot that I don't know about computers. I've only been in a Mac for almost 3 years now. It'd be 3 years in January. I love it to death, but I don't know everything. So I was going to defer to you or your years of knowledge. I know you've been in Macs since the 80s, since almost the beginning. And I'm sure there's a lot of people in the Maccast community that might have some good ideals and stuff. So if you or one of the other listeners can think of maybe another solution, I'm more than willing to listen to it. Adam, any help that you can give me with this problem, I would really appreciate, because now I'm starting to panic after I've seen this and thinking that by next week I'm going to run out of hard drive space. I look forward to hearing your advice. Keep up the good work on the show, and I'll be listening, and I'll catch you later.
Hey, Franklin, thanks for all the questions and comments, and I think we can help you out. The community is probably going to jump in here. I can't think of any other way besides, you know, getting more storage. I think you've got the right solution. I think external is probably the way to go. It's going to be the most straightforward. As far as moving the library goes, I mean, there's a few little gotchas, but having it on external, I've been doing it for a couple years now. It's not too bad. The thing I already mentioned, the one trick that I mentioned already, is that you're going to have to deal with not having your music if you go mobile. And I have a notebook, but I don't think in your case, since you're using an iMac, that's going to be as big of an issue. Moving the library is pretty straightforward. Apple actually has instructions on their support website. I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. So just find the post for this episode, scroll down a little bit, and you'll see a link that says show notes in HTML. Click on that, find the section with your comment in it, and the link will be right there. But the basic thing is, one, back up your existing iTunes library, right? And then what you're going to do is you're going to go into the iTunes preferences, you're going to go into the advanced settings, and make sure that the Keep iTunes Music Folder Organized option is checked. And then you are going to change the iTunes media folder location in the advanced preferences to point at the new location on your external drive where you want to store your iTunes media, your iTunes music. And then once you've done that, you're going to go to the file menu under library and then choose the organize library option. And then in the window that pops up, you're going to want to make sure you check on the box that says consolidate files. So you check that on and you hit OK. And again, these instructions are for iTunes 10. For iTunes 8 and 9, they're a little bit different. So just check Apple's support website. But it's pretty much the same process. The key here is that you're keeping your iTunes folder organized and you're using the consolidate files option. And then when you do that, what it's going to do is it's going to go through and it's going to copy all of your music along with all the metadata, all the information is going to be maintained, and it's going to move the actual physical MP3, audio files, iOS application files, all that stuff to your external drive. It's going to make copies of those. It's not going to actually remove the original ones that are in your home music iTunes media folder. Those are going to stay in place. Once this process is done the first time, you're going to end up with media in both locations. Once the process is complete and you verify that you can play all of your music in iTunes and it's playing off of your external drive, then you can come back in and you have your backup, right? You can come back in and then remove the iTunes media folder from your home music iTunes folder. Now, it's very important that you only remove the iTunes media folder. That's going to be the folder that has all of the audio files and things like that in them. You do not want to remove the other files and folders that are at the root of your iTunes folder. So if you look in your home folder under music, there'll be a folder called iTunes. That'll have some files in it, and then there'll be a folder in there that either says iTunes Music or iTunes Media if you're using iTunes 10. It's that media folder that you can remove. You want to leave the files like the iTunes library and iTunesLibrary.xml file there. Those are very important files. They need to stay in that location because that has all your metadata. The information about your tracks and play counts and stuff like that are stored in those files. So if you remove those, you're going to be in trouble. So leave those in place. But that'll clean up and then free the space on your internal hard drive. You're not going to have access to your music or podcasts or other things when you're not connected to your external drive. And as a matter of fact, if your external drive becomes disconnected and you launch iTunes, iTunes will default back to the default location, which is your home music iTunes folder. And if it starts auto-downloading podcasts, it's going to download podcasts to that location. Also, if you're on the road, if you take your laptop with you and you don't bring that external drive, same thing's going to happen. You can still buy music. You can still add music to your library and download it. It's just going to go to the default location. What you need to make sure you do then is when you reconnect your external drive, iTunes will recognize that drive is back there. Since that's the default location you've defined in the preferences, it's going to repoint back at that location, and you're going to need to run that file, library, organize, library, consolidate files option again. When you do that, it'll repeat the procedure, copying all that stuff you downloaded when you were on the road or when that external drive wasn't connected back over to your external drive. It'll update all your metadata pointers and stuff like that. And then again, you can clean out that home media file location and free up the space on your hard drive. Another option, if you're going on the road and you don't want to take your whole library with you, is you can set up a second iTunes library with its own separate metadata and stuff like that. Because if you don't do that, what you'll notice is when your drive's disconnected, you launch iTunes, you'll still see all of your music. It'll look like it's all there. You can browse through it. You can see the album art. You can see all that information. But when you go to play something, you're going to get a little caution icon, a little exclamation mark next to the track. It's going to ask you, it's going to say, I can't find that media file. Can you locate it? Since the external drive's not there or not connected, you're not going to be able to locate it. But what you could do is set up a separate set of metadata and put a separate copy of certain music files in another location on your internal drive to take with you. And the way you do that is when you launch iTunes, if you hold down the option key, it will give you the option to look for another library or to start a new library. So you could start a new blank library with the external drive disconnected. That's going to set the default location to be the internal hard drive. And then you could copy music from the external back into iTunes, and if you have that consolidate music option checked, it's going to copy that back into the internal drive, and then you can kind of have a subset of your library. But at that point, you're managing two copies of music libraries, and I think that's a little bit tricky. So that's why I generally recommend get a 2.5-inch drive and just take that drive with you. Just have your library on an external and just always have that handy and always plugged in, and then you're not going to run into this problem. But managing iTunes music, you know, with a laptop or just the storage of it, I think Apple, it's something that Apple has not really addressed. They haven't made it simple enough, but there's some tricks that you might be able to use. And again, I think you're on the right track going with moving it to an external drive, or just, you know, have Apple replace your internal drive with a new 1 gig drive or something like that. Whichever works for you financially, probably the external drive is the cheaper way to go, which is why I think you're thinking about it. But I hope that helps, and I think that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to thank all of my show sponsors. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook and now Notebook for iPad. You can check it all out and get free trials over at circusponies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label. Remember, right now for the holidays, you can save on Disc Label by going to smilesoftware.com/MacCast. You can get it for 30% off the regular price. Take advantage of that, and you can use Disc Label to make great holiday gifts. Pharonix, makers of Deep Freeze and PowerSave Mac. You can get more information and details at pharonix.com. And Cocotec, makers of Pathfinder 5. Awesome alternative to the Finder. Great features like tabbed file browsing. Yes, a tabbed Finder, folks. And you can get it from Cocotec. Check out their demos at cocotec.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you. 6 years later, thanks for continuing to hang out with me. It's always a great time. If you have any feedback for me, please send your emails, your audio comments. You can email them to maccast@gmail.com or call in on the listener hotline, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9 is the email address. If you'd like to leave a voicemail on Skype, you can reach me there. The Skype address is the MacCast. You'll find show notes, links to anything that I talked about in this episode or any other episode of the MacCast at the MacCast.com website. MacCast.com, obviously, is the place to go for that. And you can check out the forum while you're there, forum.maccast.com. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMacCast. You know what? I don't think it would be a MacCast holiday without playing a music track from fellow podcaster, fellow Mac geek, and just all around great guy, Matthew Ebel. I'm actually able to play this track because it's available through the PodSafe Music Network at musicalley.com. If you like what you hear, please go buy the CD or buy the album. CD, I guess it's not really a CD. Buy the tracks on iTunes. I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com, or visit Matthew's site. He also has a member program, a premium program that you can sign up for. You can get information and details at MatthewEbel.com. And this one's an original track. It's written by Matthew himself. I'm pretty sure, if I'm wrong on that, I'm sure he'll correct me, but it's called Walk 1,000 Miles by Matthew Ebel. Enjoy, and I will see you all next time.
Red eye flight, come down to me. I got somewhere else to be. I'll be leaving here at 6 a.m. to see my family. All my sweaters, they've been packed. The bitter cold won't make me crack. Once I get there, I don't know. I don't care how I'm coming back. 'Cause I would walk 1,000 miles. I would walk 1,000 miles. Through the snow, rain, or bitter cold, to be back home for Christmas. I've been gone too long to say, but I'm coming anyway. Any way I can to leave this town and get back home today. Let the snow fall through the air. I got 8 long hours to spare. I'll be waiting at the airport bar for 3, but I don't care. 'Cause I would walk 1,000 miles. I would walk 1,000 miles. Through the snow, rain, or bitter cold, to be back home for Christmas. But this long flight don't bother me. 3 men and shepherds came to see a morning, miles away from their locality. An angel singing clear, hallelujah. Christ is coming here with no plane, with no train, just a will that's still determined to find me. You know he found me, so I would walk 1,000 miles. I would walk 1,000 miles through the snow or rain, or check out lines of traffic jams. And I would walk 1,000 miles. I would walk 1,000 miles through the snow or rain or winter storms to be back home for Christmas. I would walk 1,000 miles. I would walk 1,000 miles through the snow or the rain or bitter cold to be back home for Christmas.